That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're after circulation. What we need is fireworks. People are going to hit with sledgehammers. Stir arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
This is the Week in Review for Friday. I'm Steve Scher with Knut Berger, who is the writer of the Mossback column at crosscut.com, among other places. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Steve.
Eli Sanders, who is the writer of The Slog and at The Stranger as assistant
editor. The whole slog.
The whole slog.
Not nearly.
He slogs through the slog.
That's right. That's why it's so much work. And Joni Balter, who's the host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, writes for Bloomberg View. Gives news analysis for KUOW. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So we're going to start with Billy Frank Jr. in his passing. Services are planned this weekend for Billy Frank Jr. He was the Nisqually tribal elder. He fought for Indian fishing rights in Washington, was an advocate for salmon habitat. He died at his home, Olympia. He was 83, Nisqually tribal member, as I said. He was known worldwide for his leadership in the Northwest Fish Wars of the 60s and 70s. They had fish-ins. Marlon Brando came. There was a lot of national and international attention. The Nisqually were asserting their rights to the fish in the rivers, as the state had so designated when they signed those treaties. The state, however, had opposed them. Federal government was watching. I had the really great fortune of talking to Mr. Frank just last March. We were walking down the hallway at the headquarters of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, and there's all these huge pictures up of the era and of the protests. And we stopped in front of one of the pictures of the protests.
We couldn't get the U.S. attorney to take our case. You know, we've asked him dozens and dozens of times. They wouldn't take our case. And they come down to just witness this today, and pretty soon they seen the state come down and gas us all. They had a cat, and they just took everything. The thing was, that's on the reservation.
I mean, it's pretty interesting to imagine his leadership and his William Ruckelshaus writing in Crosscut called him the Northwest Mandela, which I thought was pretty impressive and pretty true because of the way of his approach. But it's also pretty amazing to think about the state and what the state was doing to its citizens or, you know, citizens of other nations within the state back in the 60s and 70s.
It was a huge civil rights struggle. And it was one in which the Northwest Native Americans were not only in a numerical minority, but in a minority of public opinion for a long time.
Long time, huh?
The white fishermen felt like they had a right to all the fish, kind of a might makes right approach. And even though the treaties had guaranteed perpetual rights of Native Americans to fish on traditional fishing grounds, that wasn't the case. I wouldn't say it was a violent struggle, but it was a struggle that had elements of violence in it. People were being shot at. People were being gassed. You know, there was a lot of I ran into a Coast Guard's officer. This was sometime in the 1980s. We were standing in a ferry line, and he had all those ribbons, you know, tons of ribbons. And I started asking him what the various ones were for. And he said, well, this one was for active service. And I said, oh, was that Vietnam related? He said, no, this was for the Indian fishing rights controversy here on Puget Sound. And they were called out on active duty to protect and keep the white and Native American fishers separated and from harming each other. But mainly it was white fishermen who were doing the damage. And I thought that, you know, that is amazing that you know, in that far into this century, those issues were being fought out that way. And I think it was he was a really great leader in that. And I think the consequences of that, the ripple effect of the Bolt decision and the enforcement, what's happened after that, he plays a huge role in that.
Well, I love the comparison to Mandela because you have to realize this guy was arrested 50 times. You know, so he had plenty of reasons to just be mad for a very long time. But he turned all that into the productive, you know, after the half the harvestable salmon ruling, he turned that into productive working on the habitat and really, you know, environmentally sound all the way there, working for those things. And so it is, it's quite breathtaking to think about the life he led.
And the way he inspired other people to join him. There's a great picture that I posted on Slog a while back that the Secretary of State has of Marlon Brando joining the fish wars. And he's not with Billy Frank Jr. in this picture, but this is the part of the legacy of Billy Frank Jr. And so to think not only of how he channeled his frustration into productive action, but what an example that set for others and how many people that drew to his cause and how that was ultimately successful. And it's also worth pointing out, who was he fighting against? You know, these are not people that are gone and no longer with us. Slade Gorton, for example, was someone who fought on the other side of the Bolt decision.
Yeah. Jason and I this week, the producer Jason and I, were thinking about who were the other people that he was working with, who was inspiring him, who he was inspired by. You know, there was an American Indian movement leader, a filmmaker who came and worked with Frank. And there's a lot of films that are on the web and available now to see what their lives were like as they were asserting these rights. Because Frank tells a story about being on the river, in the middle of the river, in a few of them in little boats, trying to get fish, and, you know, not violent, but violent enough. They were getting shot at, shotgun pellets, and they were getting, you know, it wasn't apparently drawing blood, but they were, because it was so far from the shore, but they were getting peppered with shotgun pellets. And that was, I'm sure, the least of the problems that they faced, because there was a lot of animosity about who owned the fish and who had the right to the fish. And Frank, when I was talking to him, he talked about pollution. He wasn't like mellow in some ways. He's a pretty mellow guy, but I mean, he was angry about what was happening, what the South Sound was like, what the waters of the Sound were like, how much pollution was still going on. But in talking about it, he said, you know, his responsibility to speak for the salmon.
Yeah, that's our river, Nisqually. And that's a beautiful river. And, you know, it just, we just keep managing it. And even though the salmon are migrating out, they don't get 10 miles down and they die. We're continue to manage it. We're continue to clean up South Sound, Hood Canal, wherever the poison is, wherever the dead zones are.
I thought it was interesting that he said that his responsibility, the Fisheries Commission's responsibility, was to speak for the salmon. And that's kind of permeated the culture in the last 30 years. That wasn't that way before.
Well, it really has, because that perspective, if you're going to have half of a fishery, you want to make sure there's a fishery to have half of. But it also opened it coincided, I think, with ecological consciousness in terms of saying, well, what do we need to have a healthy fishery? Well, we have to stop polluting Puget Sound. We have to develop differently. We have to have ways that the salmon can get to and from their spawning grounds, et cetera. And that stuff has now become, much of that has been codified in state law, environmental law. Those things are still debated, but it's sort of the fact that the salmon are an indicator of the general health of the culture, the general health of the society. If you have those healthy salmon runs, it means you're doing a whole lot of things right. And I think he really helped to sort of spearhead that ethic getting embedded into public consciousness, but also law.
I was struck this week by the connection. He's dying. You know, he dies at the same time that we get this report about climate change. What's one of the most sort of troubling features of how climate change will affect the Northwest? The fact that there'll be less stream flow, and then we'll need someone to speak for the salmon again.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of speaking for the salmon, as I understand it, it's not an idea that you speak for the salmon because they are completely separate from us. They are part of the food chain that we are a part of. And so if the salmon are not healthy, we're not healthy, particularly for the Nisqually tribe or any of the other tribes that eat a lot of salmon. And when we talk about the way that this has become codified in state law, there will be an interesting test of who is now speaking for the salmon coming up on this very wonky but very consequential question of Washington State's fish consumption rates.
Yeah, I was just thinking that when you said that, yeah.
Governor Inslee will have a chance to speak for the salmon on this.
Because they're trying to decide if people who are dependent on salmon and dependent on eating salmon in the Northwest, what's the healthy level as we see fish with the higher levels of mercury
right.
and other
fish. And the question before that question is how much salmon or how much fish do Washingtonians actually consume per day or month? I'm not sure what the rate is. But when you determine that, then you start determining the healthy level of pollution in the water. And if you set the rate close to what it actually is, then you start to find that very little pollution is acceptable. And business and Boeing start to get very, very scared because they make a lot of money off of putting pollutants into our water.
Business, Boeing, folks with septic tanks, folks who are hooked up to sewage treatment plants that don't quite do the work that they're supposed to be doing. Walter Wright wrote, don't forget the fish wars are still going on up here in Whatcom County. Farmers are forming irrigation districts to protect their right to illegally take water from salmon streams. I think it's interesting how it has shifted the discussion. I mean, the tribes are at the table, right? The tribes, and I know there's animosity and there's still anger and people think, oh, there's too much shellfish in one place, there's too much salmon in another, but there's another entity that has a stake and has a place because of the legacy of Billy Frank and the people he was working with. So it's pretty amazing to see how they transformed things. If you have some thoughts, by the way, Week in Review. I keep forgetting. Week in Review at KUOW.org. Let's take a break and let's come back and make that connection between climate change and the environment in the Northwest and what we have learned this week about that. This is the Week in Review from KUOW-CF. Eli Sanders of The Strangers here, Joni Balter of Seattle Channel, Knut Berger of Crosscut, Seattle Magazine. I'm Steve Scherr. This is the Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. Eli, you found that picture of Brando at the Fish Wars in the 70s?
Yeah, I did. It's on the Secretary of State's website, and I just tweeted out a link for KUOW listeners from my Twitter feed. It's at Eli J. Sanders on Twitter. So you can see Brando standing there with a man who I believe got arrested that day or somewhere around that time for fishing those waters.
We were talking about the fish wars because we're remembering Billy Frank Jr. and his legacy passed away this week. And you were saying we should also remember this was a turbulent civil rights era and people were asserting their rights. Women, men, African Americans, Asians, Hispanics.
All of those at that time. Think about that. Yes, indeed.
It's remarkable to think about somebody who lived through that and was able to stay active and do the work he was doing and thinking about the impacts of our on our environment from our development, from our population growth. And just the image of trying to forestall the tide of development and its impact on the Sound and the salmon and everything else that lives there. I don't know. I guess it was sort of raised again for me this week because of the National Climate Assessment that was released on Tuesday. This is congressionally mandated, of course. President Obama has been talking about climate change all week. He had this as part of his interview with CBS News.
Not only is climate change a problem in the future, it's already affecting Americans. It's increasing the likelihood of floods, increasing the likelihood of drought. It's increasing the likelihood of storms and hurricanes. It's having an impact on our agriculture. It's having an impact on our tourism industries, and people's lives are at risk.
People are always looking for silver lining in these reports. So there was some report that you could say, well, dry land wheat farming in eastern Washington will probably do a little better, and maybe there'll be more markets for that because it'll be a little longer season, and other people will not be able to be growing as much. But for the most part, it doesn't look all that good. Here we are.
Sounded a little biblical to me, some of those changes that are coming directly to the Northwest.
Or are here, right?
And are coming as we speak.
Yeah.
Right.
There was some pushback at the national level. I saw a few Republican commentators, I saw on Fox News as well, that they disagree with the science. And then some people said, well, I don't disagree with the science, but I disagree with the conclusions. It was very vague. But are we past the point? Are we now actually going to start making concrete? The answer is no. Are we going to start making concrete steps?
Wait, you're giving us the answer?
I know.
This is awesome.
Like McLaughlin and Bruce. Concrete steps to actually curb our carbon emissions?
Well, we have a very active governor on this matter. He had started with his own carbon task force that he announced a week ago, so his timing wasn't too bad. I interviewed him this week on Civic Cocktail, and he had taken a few hits from some of the just different writers about whether or not he had enough business people on there. And what was an interesting answer, I thought, was he talked about the fact that he really didn't have time for climate change naysayers to be on. You know, are we going to keep debating that, or are we going to get moving? And he fairly unapologetic about that. You know, I'm going to march forward with people that want to do the work and not sit there and use that task force to debate whether or not it's occurring and whether some of it is man-made, shall we say. One poll, though, that's thinking of what you were saying, one poll that I found interesting is that, you know, Americans are now believing that there is climate change here or coming, however you want to phrase that. But a striking number don't think it will seriously affect them. And that could explain some of that Republican pushback, Mitch McConnell and some of the others.
Frogs in boiling water. That's what we are.
Literally.
True enough. True enough. We are frogs in boiling water, and we don't seem to mind so much. I guess that's back to my connection with people like Billy Frank and Billy Frank Jr., that they have made this argument and made this case for 40 years about what the Northwest, we can keep it to the Northwest, needs to do to be a safer and more environmentally sound place moving forward. It just seems, Knut, like those arguments are just pushed back by the inevitability of the people coming here and what they want to do.
Well, it isn't just the people coming here. It's the people.
People here.
Who are already here.
Yeah, we're here.
I mean, and in a sense, it's there's an element of it which is human nature, which is focus on the tangible, focus on what you can see today and worry about tomorrow. And, I think that people here in general are more, you know, very conscious of the environment, wanting to protect it. A lot of things have been codified into law. But then you have these issues that are ongoing, like non-source point pollution in Puget Sound, which is, you know, a huge percentage of the pollution that flows in every day. And that's just from the little drip, drip, drip from your car oil in the driveway or your cat poop or whatever it is. These things wash into Puget Sound and create pollution problems and problems for the species that live there. And it's really difficult to get at because it's billions of individual acts by people who are trying to live right. I mean, Seattleites, we recycle and we do all these things that we think are good, yet our collective acts mount up to something that's very difficult to get a handle on.
Well, of course, you know, temperature is going to go up. Wildfire season is going to be worse. I was struck by the other article that I read in the paper this week. Coal mining and blasting returns to King County.
Yeah, that was really
that
interesting.
Was fascinating.
So there's going to be folks looking at King County where they haven't been able to make any money on the coal. We know that there's been coal here for a long time and coal mining and Newcastle and the like. And now it may be that because of demand from China and other places, the Pacific Coal Company is applying for a permit to resume mining operations at its John Henry mine in Black Diamond.
But they said that was for cement making, that to support cement making, which sounded like, you know, more roads for more people, for new, I mean, just
well, not
spin
only that,
it out.
Well, there's that big cement plant in Sodo, I can't remember the name of it, that's like one of the biggest single sources of carbon
right.
in the atmosphere in the entire city. One single cement plant. So the idea is that you're burning coal to then feed a cement plant that's producing greenhouse gases on a massive scale. I should point out this is literally a blast from the past because Seattle was literally built on coal. We were a coal port and a coal town before we were made money, a lot of money, and a lot of other resources. Coal was the big exciting thing in Seattle.
Before timber or at the same time as
well,
timber?
Well, timber was what the first business was, a sawmill, but the big for back in the 1860s and 1870s, the big industrial excitement was around those coal fields you mentioned, Newcastle, Black Diamond. Those coal fields cut all the way up to Vancouver Island. the railroad that we built that helped make this city, probably this one of the single most important piece of infrastructure we built, was a railroad to get coal from Renton to Puget Sound. We shipped coal to California. I mean, we were the coal port that we now oppose.
It feels like we should say on the climate change question, the feeling of fatalism is just as dangerous as the denial that we hear from Republicans. And I was struck by some Garfield High School students who went down to the federal building the other day to protest against, I think it was the pipeline. What is the name of the pipeline? That's
XL, Keystone XL, or Keystone in the XL. In the Midwest.
Yeah, the Keystone XL pipeline and the Obama decision that's coming on it. But the animating concern was global warming, and their point was very good and powerfully shaming for older people who are just saying, well, the politics around this is stuck. They're saying, we have to live with this. We can't even vote, but you are leaving us the legacy of a destroyed planet. Wake up.
And did you notice that Stanford University and a bunch of other universities are now disinvesting in companies that do?
Well, there's UW and SU students who are trying to push their respective colleges to do that right now. Yeah, and Stanford was the first, best of their investments.
And the groups were trying to get Harvard to do it. They had the biggest pile of investment, shall we say, and hadn't done so yet.
Well, I do agree with you. Fatalism is just as dangerous because it could lead to inaction and I talked to a guy this week who was an energy analyst with the National Bureau of Research and worked for ARCO for a long time as a trend spotter and a futurist. And he was, you know, we're here, right? We're seeing increased temperatures. We're going to higher densities of carbon in the atmosphere. China is doing a lot of things to try to offset some of its emissions, but it's so big. There's so many coal plants still building that its efforts at wind and solar are a problem. The whole question comes down to whether we're going to pay for carbon. And one of the arguments that another guy I talked to made was, well, we still have to deal with coal. We still have to deal with carbon because it's cost effective. Look, it costs twice as much to build a solar plant as it does to build a coal-fired plant to generate the same amount of energy these days. And my question to him was, well, let's see, twice as much to pay for solar versus coal.
It's versus, the long-term thing.
Versus the planet.
Right.
It's the long-term payoff is how that should be factored.
Yeah. And there are all kinds of very cost-effective things that we've done as human beings throughout our history that we eventually decided were wrong and long-term self-defeating. And that is the push that's on right now. And that's, you know, what Inslee is trying to lead on. That's what President Obama is trying to do with the report that came out today, to shake people out of either fatalism or denial and into action, particularly action that may not be cost effective.
Yeah, or action that will be costly to those of us who are the ones who do most of the greenhouse gas emitting.
Right.
You know, speaking of elections and that, I thought there was an interesting article in Crosscut by Floyd McKay. And he had said, you know, his lead was elections have consequences. And his question is, a green line of governors. Can Inslee and Kitzhaber stop energy exports? Coal, gas, oil proposals flooding into the states, headed by governors who want to fight global warming. I mean, there's a theme to this show, which is whether we're outliers or whether we're at the forefront. So Inslee, Kitzhaber, are they?
Jerry Brown.
Jerry Brown, of course.
Yeah, it's quite a lineup, isn't it? And they're dedicated to working on this. I mean, you know, just referring to that interview that I did with Jay Inslee again this week, you know, he is really hell-bent on making a difference on global warming and climate change and just having a real impact on that.
There's another theme to the show, because I know what's coming, which is people in smaller groups trying to push a larger group that's dysfunctional. And so what you're talking about with the governors is governors trying to act when the federal government won't act.
Right.
A lot of the other issues that are running right now, from Metro to minimum wage, are about a locality trying to lead the state and the whole country on an issue that is not being addressed at a higher level, whether it's the legislature or the federal government.
Right. And before we get to that topic, can we take a moment to pray?
So the
Supreme Court said that it's okay to pray before government meetings. They said it was okay, and they did sort of say it should be fair, but they didn't really codify that. We talked to a city council commission member,
Todd Mielke,
in Vancouver, who said, "Look, you know, we were pretty fair. We tried to incorporate all the different faiths, though I didn't look at theirs, but in the municipality that was the lawsuit was brought against, they had pretty heavily Christian number of Christian ministers versus any others at their prayer meetings." What did you make of this decision?
Mildly tortured ruling, although it did reflect an earlier ruling for the Nebraska legislature that always had a chaplain get up at the beginning. But one difference, I guess, in Greece, New York, is that the citizenry do some of the praying. I'm probably in the group that says that if you do that, you're leaving some people out, which I heard the ACLU guy talking about how that leaves people out. It's fairly harmless. It doesn't really hurt anybody. And the court was in its usual divided 5-4, here we go again kind of thing. And so they went again with the, you know, and they just said, just leave it alone. It's fine. Move on. Next topic.
Next topic. What did you make of it? It's good.
Well, it's interesting because in Washington State, at various kind of state functions, or you see that they've replaced the prayer with usually a Native American invocation of some kind. So it's kind of like there's an agreement to not maybe make it a specific religious thing, but to have somebody speak. And I've seen this at a number of conferences and whatnot. And I find it really interesting because it's as if there's a kind of Native American spirituality that can sort of substitute as a secular statement of the kinds of sentiments that are often expressed in prayer. And so we've kind of found a way around that while still fulfilling the kind of traditional function of opening meetings with some kind of deal. I think it's funny, though, because I don't think the Supreme Court would have voted the way it voted if people were, opening their community meetings with things like, you know, and let us now bow to Odin and pray for his victory over the frost giants. You know, I think this is a very specific view that there's a Christian tradition in America that they want to protect here. And I think the decision is just highly questionable in that light. And I think that in terms of the day-to-day, does it affect, you know, people who are not Christian generally in a negative way? Probably not, except that, it is a way that people have used to marginalize, otherize, and exclude people. And that, you know, including in classrooms and you know, other public spaces. So anyway.
Yeah. We pledge allegiance to the flag under God, right? Yeah, I thought you were going to say something. One thing I was thinking was that I would like to see it that way. Maybe that would be a little more ecumenical. We could have the Odin worshipers, Santeria. Maybe we could have scientists, atheists. Everybody gets a shot. Comedians.
Definitely the comedians.
Everybody gets a shot to open a public meeting. And
yeah.
They could do it as
you
they
could round
they
robin
would.
It in different weeks or something.
Yeah, why not?
There you go.
Be interesting. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to we'll end that session with a prayer, and then we'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk about Metro Plan C and mega projects, and whether we should call that team in Oklahoma something other than what they're named. This is the Week in Review. This is the Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherr with Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. So supporters of Initiative 118 kicked off their signature drive last night. They have to get 20,638 voters to sign the petition to get on November's ballot. And it would raise $22 per $100,000 of property value in order to pay for bus service in Seattle, which sounds a little dicey in the first place. We'll talk about that. But yesterday, Mayor Ed Murray said, didn't support that. Raising property taxes for bus service was a bad idea. He wants a regional solution, and he says he'll offer a plan next week. What are you waiting for?
Am I the only one that has observed that he is going to offer a plan on a whole bunch of things?
Next week?
Pretty much next week. You know, he's busy and he's got his police chief nomination coming.
Is that next
he's
week?
He's got
too?
A plan. He was going to settle.
That'll be a good
the,
news week next
he
week.
He was going to settle the car share thing one of these darn weeks. I'm not sure which one. Now he's going to settle the Metro bus thing in one of these next weeks. He is a busy guy.
Well, So I read that the people who have put up Prop 1 are saying, well, look, if he's going to have a plan, then good. We've succeeded in some part in prodding some of these legislators to do something. So is this good politics, you know, pushing against these recalcitrant folks like you were talking about a little bit ago?
Well, I was focused on the reverse dynamic, which is grassroots folks forcing a reaction. Or maybe that's exactly what
I'm
sorry.
They
can call it a success, definitely. I think, you know, what I was hearing from them this week was frustration that Ed Murray, or a sense of frustration is what I picked up, that Ed Murray was going around kind of behind the scenes and calling state legislators who were endorsing or on the verge of endorsing this, like Adam Klein or Eileen Cody, and influencing them to drop their endorsement of this proposition. I think it's worth backing up and saying, okay, we're talking about Plan C here, but what was Plan A? Plan A was that the state legislature would give Seattle taxing authority and a kind of complicating taxing authority called the MVET to collect money to fund Metro, which everyone saw was going to be in crisis. The legislature failed to act. Ed Murray was a part of the legislature at the time, and so people bring that up a lot. Plan B was Prop 1, which we just saw on the ballot and which just failed, where King County was going to issue levy another car tab fee and some
sales tax
to fund Metro. That went down. So now the question immediately after Prop 1 failed was, now what? And these guys had an answer. They had Plan C, which was in their pocket, and they pulled right out. The mayor didn't immediately have an answer, and he just let that void sit there for quite a while, and these guys went ahead with their initiative. Now, when I say these guys, it's worth also remembering that Ben Schindelman, transportation advocate, is leading it, but Mike McGinn is involved. And so
this is fun.
Yeah, so that's a little bit nettlesome, I would imagine, for Mayor Murray. And he was behind the scenes discouraging people from supporting this, but he hadn't publicly offered his own plan. And when that got out, we were reporting it in The Stranger. It, I think, forced the mayor to say a little bit more. And we had this long interview with him yesterday on Slog. You can find it on The Stranger's homepage, where he explains why he's A, not very interested in speaking to Ben Schindelman, and B, or he might reverse the A and the B, but B, for these purposes, coming up with a plan of his own that will be announced next week. He's, by the way, having a press conference right now, I think probably to answer more questions about this.
Oh, I didn't know that. We'll have to track that. All right.
I'm heavily into Plan Z just because we don't know what it is.
Well, we're calling Murray's plan Plan E, for Ed doesn't like Plan C.
Well, I love how you had it. You had to click on the link that says update to even get that he was going to offer a plan.
I'm not sure anybody should like Plan C. I'm not sure any should have liked Plan B. I mean, the ultimate problem that needs to be solved is transportation is largely a state issue, and it needs to be resolved at the state level in terms of taxes. And I agree with the kinds of taxing authority it grants local municipalities. But it's also an issue of the fact that they can't get a transportation plan passed, and that transit is having a level at that difficulty getting a big enough piece of that pie. That has to be resolved. One thing that Ed Murray said when he ran for election, a lot of people said this in the wake of Mike McGinn, was that McGinn was not a very good regional leader. He was very Seattle focused. He was, Ed Murray said, "Well, I want to change that. I want to be a regional leader. We need to solve problems regionally." So, even though raising Seattle property taxes to pay for pay for Metro service to offset the cuts and whatnot, I understand why that makes sense. But I also understand that that I think Ed Murray's right in theory, that there's what you do is you have to go out and convince all those people who voted for Sound Transit but voted against Plan B to change their mind, to get back on board with transit and a plan they can support. That's kind of at the worst case. In the best case, you need that work needs to happen in Olympia.
But it is a mayor's job to take a look at the ballot as he's doing and saying, oh, my gosh, there are so many property taxes coming at the voters. And so how smart is it to have a Seattle-centric property tax that, you know, probably maybe would pass, but then we're this island, we're this iceberg, we're not with the county. And so the regional thing, to your point, Knut, is that he did go or is apparently meeting with Dow Constantine to come up with another county solution that maybe would work. For those folks who are waiting for the state to get it together, I have been wondering why there is no Republican running in the 48th district against Cyrus Habib, which, you know, the seat was vacated by Rodney Tom. And it came to me, and I heard something about this, that the Republican might be Rodney Tom.
What?
Okay, then.
We're back in some Outer Limits Twilight Zone spin.
So how does that get us a transportation package?
He said he was a Democrat last week.
Well, on the transportation package, there you start to see the absolute fury that's motivating all of this. Metro is essential for getting around in this city for people who don't want to have cars or people who can't afford cars. And anyone who's been on Metro recently knows how packed the buses are anyway. So we're talking about huge service cuts starting in September, and the state has done nothing to help us. It's not like Seattle, you know, for a long time has been itching to go it alone. Seattle lobbied the state to help it, and the state told the major economic engine of this state, of Washington State, to essentially buzz off, right? And left us hanging here with these service cuts and no solution but to go it our own.
There are still skeptics who say we're not going to see those cuts or not the cuts to the level that we have been threatened with, because money will be found. Even Ed Murray alluded to finding some additional cash that they might be able to shift over to help pay for bus service in the city from the transit budget.
Well, you know, they roll out the cuts. Is it in three phases or four, one of those? And time passes during that time. And in the recent months, because the economy is doing better, the taxes that are flowing have improved. So that's not an impossible idea that it will be less than they originally said.
Another idea that some people in the state legislature clearly have is that you bring the pain to Seattle and you let Seattleites experience it for September, October, November, December, January. The state legislature meets again. And people in Seattle, they're imagining, are fed up and begging for a transportation package to be passed. And now they'll be able to get a transportation package through with some money for Metro, but also getting people in the Puget Sound region on board with things they probably wouldn't otherwise support, which are, you know, huge amounts of money for highways. And so it's a political hostage taking, that's motivating the long game here for some people in the legislature. And that hostage taking is what the people behind Keep Seattle Moving, the ballot initiative or Plan C, if you want to call it, are trying to blow up. They don't want that hostage taking to succeed.
By the way, do we know what highways we're talking about when there would be expanding highways?
Well, the package has been talked about for some period of time. Some widening of 405, some work on 167. Spokane.
605 being proposed again?
JBLM.
Oh, the JBLM cross.
What's the number in Spokane, the north-south?
So it was interesting what you said about the folks that voted for Sound Transit turned around and didn't vote for this package, because you were referring in part to this interesting Ben Anderstone article that was in Crosscut and on his own page, and there was this map of who voted and who didn't, again, just trying to get a little more understanding of it. Also a guy named Brandon Martin Anderson's map. What happened, do you think?
Well, I mean, looking at the precinct analysis, what you see is that Seattle voted heavily for the Proposition 1, the areas, and that little parts of Bellevue and Redmond and Mercer Island and other places also supported it at fairly high levels. What you found was that those voters just weren't enough to outweigh the voters, the suburban voters. But the interesting analysis was he went through and looked
voters,
at the exurban voters, yeah. But also a lot of suburban voters as well. And when you look at and there were Seattle precincts also that voted against it, and some of those were the kind of outside the donut rim, neighborhoods that aren't very transit dependent.
West Seattle,
but there were some
Magnolia.
Like South Beacon Hill and others, which generally vote very liberal, that voted against it. And they tend to, those are often low income areas with lots of immigrants and whatnot that don't like regressive taxes. And but what was interesting was to compare the areas, he compared the areas that voted for the Sound Transit measure and then what the drop-off was in those identical areas. So you had areas that really heavily supported Sound Transit on the second vote that voted heavily against this proposition. And so what his question is why? You know, what you have to get at is why. This isn't just car lovers versus bus riders. That's part of it, perhaps. But what was the toxic element of Prop 1? Was it the car tab element? What is that? So I think you have to do some sort of analysis as to what was going on there. What was the messaging? What wasn't working about the messaging? What wasn't working about the wording of the proposition, all those kinds of things? Because there are clearly pro-transit voters who voted against it. So how do you get those people back if indeed you go to another countywide vote?
Well, doom and gloom doesn't work for messaging. You need to give people a positive to think about instead. We know that's a message. But is there, you talked about revenue, tax revenues going up a little bit, but it's a regressive tax. People aren't feeling, tax revenues may be going up, but people aren't feeling all that great about the money they're making. People haven't had raises in a long time. And I mean, is that who also voted?
And I hate to say this on the anniversary of the day that Bertha Knight Landis was elected to the city council, but Bertha is not helping. Sorry. Bertha is this example of folks who, of a project that has money, tons of money, and it's not working. And worse than that, it's going to go on for such a long period of time while it's not working. So anything you ask the voters for during that time, is in some way shaded by what is happening with Bertha, which is just plain stuck.
I think that's very, very right. Even though you're talking about different pots of money, different funding sources, in the general consciousness, all of this kind of merges into a sense of we're not giving the state any more money for transportation. They can't even get the big transportation projects they have going right. And it's not just Bertha. The Seattle Times had this great slideshow this week of the major transportation projects that are stuck or on hold or broken or in rewrite, like with the 520 bridge pontoons is one of them. Bertha is the other. The Columbia Crossing is going nowhere. And then there's just miles and miles of highways to repair and bridges that are broken and not getting repaired. And so you take all of that and then you send voters a request to throw some more money at something. Even if it's worthy, it's hard to get them past that hurdle of we're already mad about these other things that you haven't fixed.
So it's the it's Tim Eymann's philosophy of making us having us vote on things and also cutting taxes. I'll put that all on Tim Eymann. coming back to haunt us in a sense because we're fatigued. We're fatigued by it, and at the same time, we see no benefit in what we're getting.
The other part of Eymann that's haunting us right now is the restriction on property taxes. We could actually solve this problem and not be pitting pre-K against parks against transit in Ed Murray's mind if we didn't have this limit on the amount that we could increase property taxes in any given year. And that traces back to an Eymann initiative.
But it's the past and the future, the things we asked for money for in the past and all the things that are coming. And people are just going, freeze.
Yeah, they could be. And we may be frozen with crowded buses and we may come to accept that or we may come to then see a change. But it seems like we are. I mean, we're asking, are we politically in gridlock? Maybe we are socially in gridlock right now as well.
This goes back to our conversation about global warming because
part
of the trade-off that comes with these transportation packages is in order to get transit, you need to fund bad road projects. In other words, the trade-off is, well, we'll do everything. we'll do it all. That's the political solution, as opposed to somebody coming up with the best plan for the state and getting that passed. You end up with something that becomes kind of an intolerable mess, but it's kind of better than the alternative. And then what happens is, so that's what happened. I mean, we had these huge mega projects approved, and it was really unprecedented. The time frames that we were trying to get all this stuff done on is unprecedented. Now they've gone haywire at some level. And, you create a certain skepticism. And the only way out is throwing more resources at something that you perhaps shouldn't have done in the first place. Can we blame people for getting tired and cynical about the way we do things? And I can understand Ben Schindelman and those guys saying, let's bite off what we can chew that we know is right and let's do it. I mean, I totally get that. And I think that's where you get a kind of, in some ways, you can compound the problem by increasing tax burdens on people. But you also are at least have the sense that you can control and do the right thing without so many of the negative trade-offs.
Real tightly, I'll just say that that is the nature of asking voters for something. You say, do you want like the museum and some other thing like the zoo? So you get this percentage for the museum, this percentage for the zoo. That wasn't actually the right pairing, but they've done these pairings before as a way to get north of 50%.
Right. Zoo and parks, for example.
Right. And what McGinn and Schindelman are saying is we're done with that hostage taking. You're holding one thing hostage to another thing, and we don't support both things. We only support one. And I absolutely agree with Knut. I think in the end, what's motivating them is, yes, pro-transit advocacy, but foundationally, environmentalism. They do not want to see these highway projects go through because they think long term that's bad for the planet. And so they just want to focus on transit in Seattle.
More on this on the record at 2 o'clock when our Week in Review Extra. But you know who we've been holding hostage? Luke Burbank. How's that feel?
Well, I kept blinking twice to try to indicate to the listeners I was being held, but it didn't seem to translate through the radio.
Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire. That's on KOW 8 o'clock Friday nights. He's also host of the TBTL podcast. Appears on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You didn't get to talk about Monica Lewinsky's return to the public this week, did you?
No, I missed that one, but I don't know. I wasn't that sad to not get the opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. We have this question for you because we thought it was funny. We try to find funny things to ask you because that's what we do.
Okay.
Seattle TV station Cairo refers to the Oklahoma City Thunder as former Sonics when they throw up their graphics. Isn't it time to let it go, Luke?
What's interesting is that Cairo actually posted a statement on its website laying this out. This wasn't just like one sports update guy who decided to get creative. This is apparently a company-wide policy. And my initial reaction is, good, let's not give the Oklahoma City team the satisfaction they want. Let's not give, in particular, Clay Bennett and the others who move the team that satisfaction. But it does smack of being a little obsessed. It's sort of, like if you referred always to your ex as the one who reunited with an old flame on Facebook. Or something else. It just seems like you're
a little personal to me.
Can I read you a couple of comments from Oklahoma City, though? Because I went, speaking of Facebook, to the Facebook page of the Oklahoma City TV station, the Cairo down there called News 9. Someone called Cameron said, "The Thunder is now our basketball family. They bring happiness and loudness to OKC. That is why we are called Loud City. Seattle needs to get over it." And then Rhonda said, "Their owner sold the team because of poor support from the city and state. You sure can't say that about Oklahoma. ! And you wonder why today's children act the way they do when they have these kind of adults as role models." So the problems really for the children of Seattle, it's not schools, it's not lack of access to resources, it's that their parents are not calling the Oklahoma City Thunder the Thunder.
Yeah. By the way, I like their motto, Thunder Up.
Yeah.
I like the idea that Clay Bennett is some kind of adult role model.
There you go.
For kids.
And what is this contest over Loud? I thought we had that down.
Well, apparently
yeah,
not anymore.
Exactly.
We're Louder City. Loud S City. We'll just keep claiming that.
I guess it's time for me to stop calling the Mariners the new Pilots. You got to let go sometime.
That's one of your cute, irascible tendencies.
Well, I don't know. I still call it the Kingdome, and it's gone.
Yeah.
You got anybody really great on your show tonight that will be talking about Monica Lewinsky's dress?
Well, we asked Ken Jennings, who is one of the guests tonight, to talk about it, and we even formed the request in the form of a question, and he declined. So we will have Ken Jen. We will not be discussing Monica Lewinsky. But interestingly enough, you know, Ken Jennings is the world champion of Jeopardy. He's won the most episodes in a row. He's also a practicing Mormon. And what we got into in the conversation was how he squares his very rational Jeopardy-winning science brain with his spiritual brain, which kind of gets back a little bit to stuff you guys were talking about earlier in the show, I think.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'd like to hear that. By the way,
if you tune into KUOW tonight at 8, Steve.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I also want to say that I watch Jeopardy because my mom and I like to watch it, and it's the Battle of the Champions. Ken Jennings was on last night. The guy's incredible. He could name, he could answer, so he was four times higher than everybody else in winnings that for that show. People were asked to convert famous people's initials, and the clue was sort of a clue to the famous person's, and you'd get their initials, and then you had to figure out how that would be converted into Roman numerals. And Ken, and Ken Jennings was doing it at, you know, all the rest of us got it, but it took us like 10 seconds, right? 15 seconds. He was just done. So I hope
don't
you
even understand the premise of the category. So that shows you where I'm at.
All right. Well, Luke Burbank, I don't know if B was in the Roman numerical system, but if it was, we'll figure it out. All right, Luke, take care.
Thank you very much.
Joni Balter, thank you very much. I don't know why I'm pointing to Skip. But nobody saw that but you guys. Joni Balter, thank you very much. Eli Sanders, thank you very much. Knut Berger, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jason Pagan, who produces the show, thank you very much. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. Thank you very much.
Steve Scherer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And folks, thank you very much for listening. Have a good weekend.